This is Party on the Peninsulas, your weekly update on the people and policies leading Michigan, with Michigan Democratic Party Chair Lavora Barnes.
Welcome back to Party on the Peninsulas. I'm Lavora Barnes. The word this week, memories.
Next Tuesday, all of you will go to the polls, will stand there in the polling place and make a decision. I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
One thing some politicians rely on during their campaigns, how time weakens our memory. It's a tactic that Donald Trump's campaign is using right now, hoping Americans don't remember just how bad things were 4 years ago. For the first half of his term, Trump rode the wave of the eight-year Obama economic recovery. But by the end of Trump's term, that wave disappeared thanks to his bungled non-response to the COVID pandemic. Let's go back 4 years and revisit the reality Donald Trump would have us forget. March 2020, unemployment was at 4.4%, but a month later, it was at a staggering 14.8%. By the time Trump left office, his four-year record saw the loss of 3 million jobs, the worst jobs number for a president since Herbert Hoover. This week, the monthly jobs report showed another 275,000 Americans were employed. Unemployment has been under 4% for a record 39 months, dating back to the beginning of the Biden administration. March 2020, a total of 80 U.S. cases of COVID had been reported. At the White House, Trump told Bob Woodward in private that he knew COVID was extremely deadly and highly contagious.
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes, sir.
Because I don't want to create a panic.
You just breathe the air. That's how it's passed. It's also more deadly than your strenuous flus.
But here's what he was telling the public 4 years ago.
We have it totally under control. It's one person coming in from China. And we have it under control. It's going to be just fine.
And we think we have it very well under control. We have very little problem in this country at this moment, five. And those people are all recuperating successfully. But we're working very closely with China and other countries. And we think it's going to have a very good ending for us. So that I can assure you.
Now, the virus that we're talking about having to do, you know, a lot of people think that goes away in April with the heat, as the heat comes in. Typically, that will go away in April. We're in great shape. We have 12 cases, 11 cases, and many of them are in good shape now.
We have it very much under control in this country.
And again, when you have 15 people, and the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero. That's a pretty good job we've done.
Under control? Huh. 1.2 million Americans have died from COVID. Our economy had begun to shut down from the pandemic. Hospitals in many cities, including in Detroit and Lansing, were jammed to capacity by COVID cases. We had nationwide shortages of personal protective equipment, N95 masks, respirators, protective clothing, and even exam gloves. Worldwide supply chains were disrupted, setting the stage for a logjam in the supply chain that would disrupt our economy for 3 years. To his credit, Trump pushed the development of the first COVID vaccine, but he didn't put in place the plan for getting the vaccine to the people. Joe Biden came into office with the goal of getting 100 million Americans vaccinated within 100 days. It happened in 58 days. Nearly half of the U.S. population was vaccinated within the first 6 months. It was the beginning of the end of the pandemic. COVID no longer threatened to shut down America. What about crime? Trump regularly claims violent crime has skyrocketed. The facts say otherwise. In March 2020, after a 15-year decline in violent crime, as reported by the FBI, crime spiked 28% in 2020, the last year of the Trump term. The most recent numbers show 2023 with the lowest crime rate since before the pandemic.
Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
The answer is yes. This nation is better off now than it was 4 years ago. Trump will do his best to make us think otherwise, but he has no choice. He was a disastrous president, and his return to office would be devastating. Coming up, The state legislature is working on new initiatives to make our kids safer at school. We'll talk with State Representative Matt Kolesar, chair of the House Education Committee, on what that means for your children. But first, an update on some of the week's political and policy news from MDP's Dorian Tyatt.
In the news this week, the U.S. economy added 275,000 jobs in February, a sign of continued strength for the jobs market, benefiting workers despite higher interest rates. The report, which beat expectations, marked the 39th straight month of job gains in what economists broadly consider an exceptionally strong recovery from the widespread job losses wrought by the coronavirus pandemic. A year ago, many analysts had predicted that the Federal Reserve's campaign to raise interest rates to ease inflation would lead the economy into a painful downturn, but that hasn't happened. The unemployment rate has stayed below 4% for more than 2 years, the longest run since the 1960s. Layoffs remain lower than pre-pandemic levels. Michigan Democrats and Biden for president launched the first one campaign office of 2024 this week to expand outreach to voters and re-elect President Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, and Democrats up and down the ballot. Biden-Harris 2024 campaign co-chair Senator Chris Coons joined Representative Haley Stevens and Mayor Mike Duggan to rally supporters and highlight the stakes of this election for countless issues affecting Michiganders and for democracy itself. This office is the first of many as the One Campaign continues to knock on doors, call voters, and remind Michiganders of all the accomplishments of the Biden-Harris administration, from lowering costs to creating good union jobs, to fighting to protect reproductive freedom while Trump and his Michigan MAGA Republican allies pursue more and more extremist policies and threaten our economy. Nearly 150 Republican lawmakers, including five U.S. representatives from the state of Michigan, filed a brief with the U.S. Supreme Court last week, urging it to significantly restrict access to the nation's most commonly prescribed form of abortion medication. Among them, Michigan Republican Congressman Jack Bergman, Bill Huizinga, Lisa McClain, John Molinar, and Tim Walberg. The recent legal filing asked the nation's top court to restrict access to mifepristone, one of two drugs used in more than half of abortions nationwide, by prohibiting it from being used after 7 weeks of pregnancy, being prescribed via telemedicine, or being sent through the mail. An Arizona grand jury has issued subpoenas to Republicans who took part in the attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election by signing and transmitting paperwork that falsely purported to show Donald Trump had won the state's 11 electoral votes. They are part of a year-long investigation by Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, who has indicated that her office would soon conclude the criminal probe. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel, along with prosecutors in Georgia and Nevada, have brought charges against pro-Trump electors. The Republican National Committee voted Friday to install Donald Trump's hand-picked leadership team, completing his takeover of the National Party as the former president closes in on a third straight presidential nomination. Michael Whatley, a North Carolina Republican who has echoed Trump's false theories of voter fraud, was elected the party's new national chairman in a vote Friday morning in Houston. Lara Trump, the former president's daughter-in-law, was voted in as co-chair. Trump's team is promising not to use the RNC to pay his mounting personal legal bills. But Trump and his lieutenants will have firm control of the party's political and fundraising machinery with limited, if any, internal pushback. The secretive third-party organization, No Labels, voted on Friday to move forward with its presidential ticket, according to a virtual meeting the group held with its delegates. But an official with the group acknowledged during the gathering that they currently do not have a candidate and may not find one. Leaders of the group, which is funded by anonymous big money donors, had said in the past it wouldn't run a candidate unless it saw a clear path to victory. That has apparently changed. The call, which was a virtual gathering of more than 600 delegates, was directed by Mike Rawling, a Democratic former mayor of Dallas. "We don't have a candidate," Rawling said, "and it's possible in the end we won't find a suitable candidate." Regional leaders on the call expressed support for proceeding with a third-party presidential bid in the wake of Biden and Trump now clearly emerging as their party's respective presidential nominees. A law firm, best known for championing conservative causes, made nearly $750,000 last year working as the new attorney for Ottawa County. Invoices obtained by the Grand Rapids Press through a Freedom of Information Act request show Kallman Legal Group billed the county and its insurance authority for almost 3,000 hours of work in 2023. Kallman Legal Group's bill last year for corporation counsel work was more than double the $240,000 the county paid for contracted corporation counsel services in budget year 2022, the last full year that Doug Van Essen, Kallman Legal Group's predecessor, was contracted in the position. Kallman Legal Group was hired in January 2023 to replace Van Essen as part of a larger, surprise shakeup by the new ultra-conservative county board majority called Ottawa Impact. The law firm isn't known for and doesn't list experience in municipal law necessary for corporation counsel work on its website. Kallman Legal Group is best known for taking on cases challenging the state's shutdown orders during the COVID-19 pandemic and defending businesses that deny LGBTQ people service based on religious beliefs. Links to these and other stories are on our website, partyonthepeninsulas.com. From Michigan Democratic Party headquarters in Lansing, I'm Dorian Tyus.
Joining the podcast this week is the chair of the State House Education Committee, Matt Kolesar. Representative Kolesar is serving his third term, representing Michigan's 22nd House District, which includes the cities of Northville and Plymouth, most of Northville and Plymouth townships, and a portion of Livonia. Prior to his election, Kolesar worked as a teacher and coach in the Airport Community School District and president of the Airport Education Association in Carlton. He received an undergraduate degree from Saginaw Valley State University before attending Eastern Michigan University, where he received a master's degree in English Studies. Representative Kolesar is committed to securing adequate funding for Michigan schools, finding effective solutions to fix the roads, and increasing access to health care in the state. As a part of that commitment, he's leading his committee's work on school safety, with a focus on mental health resources for our children. He discussed the efforts to make schools safer for all kids with our Walt Sorg.
Representative Kolesar, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. A pleasure to welcome you.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
The work you're doing is under the radar, yet if you ask a parent about it, it's the most important thing you could be doing, dealing with the safety of our kids. The headlines, especially right now with the trial over the Oxford shooting, is about safety in the schools from shootings. But that's not what you're looking at. You're looking at things that go much deeper than that, are actually a little more complex. What are some of the things your committee's looking at?
Absolutely. So there's been an entire conversation about school safety for as long as I've been in the legislature. But in the last year, we've seen a lot of action actually taken on it. And I want to start by looking back at the budget that we passed back in the late spring, where we included over $300 million over 2 years for mental health investments in schools. And we also invested almost $320 million that was designed specifically for school safety. So if you think about infrastructure improvements in our schools that our schools could use and actually personalize to what they need, because no two school districts are the same, and it gives them the personalization they needed for their buildings. And that could be hiring school resource officers. It could be improving, for example, window coverings that you can see outside, but outside can't see inside, things of that nature, but also substantial mental health support. So we started there, but the bill package in particular that I'm looking at has actually been a product of a bipartisan school safety task force that was headed up by, on the Democratic side, Representative Kelly Breen, and on the Republican side, Representative Luke Meerman. And they've been working on that. Really, this was a bill package that was introduced last term, but was nowhere near ready for committee vote or for floor vote. Hence why I'm going to assume that's why the Republicans never ran it. We got it this term, and I allowed them to, I gave them the latitude they needed to complete their work and talk to all of not just law enforcement, who the Republicans had spoken to, but the education community, all the different schools, school stakeholders, and have those conversations to have the best possible bill. And I think some of those bills are just about ready that we'll hopefully see them in committee very soon.
You talk about mental health for students. Where is the need coming from? Is it through the general stresses in society? Is it social media? Is it a combination of factors where you see the need for more mental health support?
My answer to that question would be yes. There's some issues lingering from the pandemic as well. That was a very difficult time on everybody, but especially our children. And one of the biggest issues that we have seen in terms of in our schools is we just don't have the staff that we need. There's not enough people. We have a major labor shortage across a variety of industries, as I'm sure. And that definitely includes our school mental health professionals, our school psychologists, and our school social workers, not to mention our school counselors. We have one of the worst school counselor to student ratios in the country. And so attracting and retaining those individuals to stay in our schools is incredibly important to me. And we're actually going to be having a committee hearing on that issue from the experts on Monday evening, actually, next week. We are actually taking the House Education Committee on the road, and we are going to Sterling Heights High School from 5:30 to 7 o'clock to talk about school safety and talk about this mental health care worker shortage that we have. And we'll be hearing from representatives from the Michigan School Counselors Association, the school psychologists, and the school social workers, as well as administration from Warren Consolidated Schools, as well as the principal of Chippewa Valley. So I'm really looking forward to having, I guess you could call it, a very Macomb-centric evening, but we are very grateful for Warren Consolidated Schools for hosting us. And to put the House Education Committee into a school is something that, as far as I can tell, has not been done in generations.
Another area which I see just as I watch my grandkids in school, little kids, is the lack of physical activity anymore for kids in schools. They don't get nearly the opportunity for the outlet of physical activity that is so necessary, really, to keep them focused during the day. They come home and they're so wired.
So there actually is a pretty significant push from a lot of people about mandatory recess for our elementary school students and making sure that they have the ability to go outside and go play, be kids, go out there and work off some of that excess energy. And I think that one also has bipartisan support. It's just a matter of systematically what is it going to look like in terms of the framework of a school day.
What kind of feedback are you getting from the teachers?
Teachers in the last year have, by and large, been very appreciative of things that we've done in the legislature over the last year. I actually like to tell this story all the time. My district is Plymouth, Northville, portion of Livonia, and my wife and I were at the Plymouth Farmers Market right before the holidays, and these two teachers who I had never met before stopped me and asked, "Are you Matt Colazar?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "We appreciate all the work you're doing. Like, we actually feel valued, finally. It has been forever." And that meant more to me than words can describe. And I think the reason that we're hearing that is, one, we are making incredible strides on properly funding education. And we still have a way to go. But we have really made some major strides in trying to get to that fully funded number for education. It's the first time in Michigan's history we fully funded the Special Education Foundation allowance. In addition, we gave teachers a greater say in their working conditions. We did some things to make teacher retirements more secure and better. Myself and Senator Polhanke worked on making the teacher evaluation process one that's much more productive and is something that will benefit them and make them better teachers. So we've just done a lot of good work that shows, look, we need to make sure when we look at our public schools, we need to look at everything from everyone, from the kids that are there to the adults that are teaching them. We need to make sure that entire community is supported.
You mentioned earlier that one size doesn't fit all when it comes to our school districts. Has anything come up in differences between the more rural areas and the urban areas, such as where you are? You're in the suburbs of Detroit. Differences that surprised you?
I wouldn't say that the differences surprise me. I think the most stark difference is, even when we make this funding available to our schools, a lot of times rural school districts do not have the staffing levels necessary in their front offices to properly apply for all those grants. So sometimes money gets left on the table because they just don't have the people. They're necessary. They often tell me, if you go into a suburban district, you're going to have whole departments that might be working on these grants. We've got one person in the office And a lot of times that does create issues for them in terms of actually getting the funding they need. So it's something that I would say that if you're not in Lansing, it might be something that most people aren't aware of if they don't work in the school system, but it's a big challenge. Again, the public school staffing shortage is real, and it is a big problem, and it hurts across a variety of ways.
There's also a huge disparity between the physical plants of the various school districts. Even within a school district, there could be a lot of differences. But when you go from a really old urban district to a new suburban district, it's like night and day. Is there anything, obviously money would make a huge difference there. Is that something, though, that the legislature can attack?
Yes, and we have been attacking it. A lot of it, I would say, is we've been working on equitable funding. And that equitable funding, those equitable funding models definitely do help districts that are, whether they are urban or rural, it helps them stay, or at least we're closing the gap to put everyone on a fair footing. And I think we've done a lot of very good work there. I know that there's still more to do, but I think a lot of times, again, allowing schools to personalize what they need, especially in terms of their infrastructure improvements. We know not everywhere approves a bond issue either. It depends on where you are. Some constituencies don't want to pass bond issues. Others do. That can put different school districts in different positions as well.
You talk about the funding. Michigan fundamentally changed its school aid funding formula about 30, 40 years ago. As I recall, the chief sponsor of that change was a state senator by the name of Debbie Stabenow. Is the funding mechanism something that really needs to be reworked or at least rethought about?
I think everybody would agree that we do need to look at it. The problem is, how do you change it? And how do you change it in a way that's beneficial for all? I don't know that we have those answers. That's why we, given the current system that we have, we are trying to do everything within the current system to get to that equitable funding that we know we need to get.
If people want to get involved more with your committee's work, what's the best way for them to move forward?
Always contacting members of the committee, especially if those members of the committee are your state representative. But even then, I get emails and calls from superintendents and teachers and support staff from all over the state. And I welcome every last one of them when they come in. I talk to many of them personally, even if they're not in my district. If you're calling me and you're a superintendent from the west side of the state, you are very much impacted by the work we do in the education community. I always encourage them to reach out.
I want to conclude by giving you a chance to answer the question that has probably been asked of every legislator over the last four decades. I thought the lottery was supposed to take care of all of this.
I wish it did.
In truth, the lottery is just a small part of the school aid fund.
It is. In just about every state, education is the biggest slice of any state's budget. And so it is incredibly expensive, and rightfully so. It should be expensive. Because we know the more we spend on our kids, that is an investment. That's not spending. That is an investment in future generations. So, yes, it's only one small piece of a very large puzzle.
Representative Matt Kolesar, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. And best of luck with this most important issue.
Thank you all. Appreciate you having me today.
I can't let this podcast end without some comments on President Biden's State of the Union address. It was superb. Putting to rest the baseless Republican assault on the president's capability to continue as one of the most effective presidents in U.S. history. Ironically, it came in the same week that featured some Donald Trump speeches where his sentences evolved into incoherent babbling, raising serious questions about his mental state. It wasn't just President Biden's strong presentation. It was also his vision for America, virtually limitless possibilities for the nation. That was a stark contrast to his predecessor's continuing tearing down of our nation, calling it weak, disrespected, and even failing. President Biden laid out his vision for improving the lives of all Americans, building on the tremendous successes of his first 3 years. In the after-speech commentary, I was struck by one analyst who said on Bill Maher's real-time show that President Biden is the first president in years who is focused on the long term. A commitment to leave a better country and better world for our children and grandchildren, rather than focusing on short-term politically driven policies. Signature Biden successes like promoting U.S. manufacturing of computer chips, infrastructure investments, and attacking climate change aren't proposals designed as instant gratification laws. They are laws that set the stage for world leadership for the next 50 years or more. I was also deeply disappointed, but not surprised, by the Republican incivility and downright rudeness during the speech that seems to get worse every year. We remember our shock when Congressman Joe Wilson shouted out, "You lie," at President Obama during a State of the Union speech.
The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegal. It's not true.
Now, outbursts like that are seemingly a regular feature of Republican congressional behavior. The heckling from the likes of Marjorie Taylor Greene is an embarrassment, and it's gotten so bad the Speaker of the House couldn't even find it in himself to applaud when President Biden said there was no role for violence in politics, or that United States would not bow down to Russian dictator Vladimir Putin. When did those become partisan issues? Unfortunately, Donald Trump's crude and rude behavior seems to have become the norm for many elected Republicans. One final note as we wrap up this week's podcast. Congratulations to Lara Trump on her election as co-chair of the Republican National Committee. I'm sure she really nailed the job interview. That's this week's report from your Michigan Democratic Party. I'm Lavora Barnes. Thank you for listening.
Paid for by the Michigan Democratic Party, 606 Townsend, Lansing, Michigan, 48933.